This is InvestTalk, independent thinking, shared success. Justin Klein and Steve Peasley stand ready to take your finance and investment questions and share their unbiased answers. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. The clarity for your path forward starts now. Here is KPP Chief Executive Officer, Financial Advisor, Justin Klein.
Good afternoon, fellow investors, and welcome back to InvestTalk. This is our Thursday, April 6th, 2023 edition. And I have today with me, once again, since it is Thursday, Luke Guerrero. Welcome back, Luke.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
Of course. Now, today we are going to dive into the various dynamics that are impacting the markets today. Obviously, geopolitical concerns are a big factor, much bigger than we've seen in the past, and different market dynamics with higher inflation, higher interest rates, all of these things have large ramifications across the many asset classes. So we're going to discuss all of this and try to unpack as much as we can for you so you can make good sound decisions with your money. Now, I'm Justin Klein with Luke Guerrero, and that's our goal. And it's to help give you unbiased, or not help, to actually give you unbiased answers to your questions. And we're not here to push anything, just trying to give you some perspective, positives and negatives of every asset class. There's always risks and rewards for everything that you're looking at. It's important to be not to be dogmatic and fall in love with any one type of investment and understand the pros and cons of each. And that's what we're here to do. So your participation is vital. It's important. And you push the agenda on today's show. We have things that we want to discuss, but ultimately it's really about you. And we're here to shape your thinking, your mindset, so you can become a successful investor, so you don't fall prey to the many pitfalls that the average investor tends to fall into by using emotions over logic. So we're trying to keep your feet on the ground and focus on the facts at hand. So our toll-free line, as always, is 888-99-CHART. You can call that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and leave your message, and we'll answer that on a future show. Or if you're listening now live, 4 to 5 Pacific time, each and every weekday, you can call and talk to us live, okay? So now we've got a lot to cover on today's podcast. My main focus point regards to the story behind this question: which stocks perform worst in Q1? You can probably guess a little bit, but we're going to look at the data. Look at 844 U.S. stocks. This is covered by Morningstar, and 29 fell more than 20% in the first quarter. And we're going to look at some of those underperformers and give you our perspective if maybe that underperformance is going to continue. All right. So we're going to look at that. Also, how ESG should be regulated. I know Luke is a big fan of this one. And then Landlords are cutting rents. Vacancy rates are rising pretty dramatically. So we're going to check in on the rental markets across the country. And then lastly, the JOLTS data, job openings that came out earlier this week. So we're going to look at that data and help you understand where the jobs market might be heading into tomorrow, which is Good Friday. It's a market holiday, but there will be a jobs number coming out. We also have some voice bank questions ready to play. One is on Charles Schwab and the other is on retirement funds. So I've got this all planned for this episode of InvestTalk. But of course, your live calls are number one at 888-99-CHART. Now the market, let's take a look at the market today. It was a positive day, but pretty minor, right, Luke?
Yeah, pretty minor. I think it's important to note, coming off a little bit of a rally in March, it was pretty flat on the week for the first week of the new quarter.
Yeah, a little consolidation, shall we call it, in the technical term. And it's not shocking to see a bit of consolidation going into, or a bit of kind of flat market going into the jobs data, which is certainly going to be vital to future Fed policy. And right now, the market's kind of pricing in rate cuts by September. Isn't that right?
Yep, by September and potentially. I saw day over day the chance of one more rate cut in May has gone up about 3%. It stands at 53% today.
Yeah, so the jobs number will probably feed into how market expectations shift and whether that is going to beat or miss. We'll see that tomorrow, even though the market is closed. And then I think next week is the CPI data, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, so that's, I think, why you're getting a bit of consolidation, waiting to see where those numbers come in at and how that will affect future policy. All right, now let's head over to our first listener question now.
Hi, this is Steve. I have a question about Huntington Ingalls Industries. It's a military shipbuilding company. I really like that space and I want to invest in it. At the current price, I see it's falling down. This is a good time to pick that up. Let me know. Thanks.
All right, this is Huntington Ingalls Industry. They build and repair U.S. Navy nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, submarines, destroyers. So they're in the aerospace and defense department. And obviously consistent business. This is the U.S. government, the military industrial complex, and they tend to do very well. Obviously, this is maybe a play on a war with Taiwan. What do you think, Luke?
Yeah, I think, like you said, one of the biggest businesses of the U.S. government is war, and certainly this is a time that is contradictory to, you know, the end of the 20th century, and that there's heightened tensions. So I think this would probably be a good type of business to invest in.
Yeah, I think you really have to believe that we'll go into some hot war with China. I personally don't believe so. I think we are going to, we've started to realize that they've been in an economic war. If you watch or if you read The Art of War, you kind of want to hit the enemy where they aren't expecting it. And that's kind of what they've done over the past 10 years or so. And now we're kind of waking up to that with industrial policy, with the CHIPS Act and the Inflation Reduction Act. And so I think that's where it's going to be a tit for tat type of thing. But I could be wrong. If you're in the camp that there will be some sort of hot war over the next maybe 5 to 10 years with China, I think this is the one to be in, because a hot war with China would probably be on sea, correct? Right, Luke?
That's true. I will also say, though, a best offense is a good defense, is what they say in sports. And that can certainly be the case for these types of companies as well. You don't necessarily have to get into that open conflict for the defensive positioning to be strengthened by their customers.
Well, what about the expectation of a potential budget crisis over the next 5 years? You know, our debt is pretty large. Do you think military spending will be cut?
You know, it's one of those things where it's always on the table, but it doesn't seem like it ever is. Yeah. I saw a recent survey, actually, that said an overwhelming majority of Americans wanted the federal budget to be cut. But when you go line item by line item, they wanted each individual item to be raised. So that was an interesting one.
Yeah, it's a conundrum we'll probably have to approach at some point, probably in our lifetimes, Luke. But it doesn't seem to be in the near term. Now, on the technical side of Huntington, let me pull that up right. Huntington Ingalls Industries, it is in a downtrend. So I would wait on it. The technicals to me kind of override what looks to be a decent company at a decent price. But I would pass on it until the fundamental or the technicals improve more. And it just started its downtrend back in November. And so I would pass on Huntington Ingalls at the moment, but keep on your watch list for improvements in the technicals. Now we're going into a quick break, and you can call anytime with a question when it comes to mind and leave it on the Invest Talk voice bank. Or if you're listening live, you can call right now at 888-99-CHART.
In today's world, a variety of factors are affecting the stock markets. Serious investors know building a secure financial future requires hard work and determination. That's why now, more than ever, when it comes to the planning, execution, and maintenance of your portfolio, you need InvestTalk. With total downloads surpassing 50 million, each InvestTalk podcast should be one of your key financial planning and educational tools. InvestTalk is a free download. And hosts Justin Klein and Steve Peasley stand ready to provide their unbiased guidance and professional analysis developed from real-time data research and years of investing experience. 24/7, rain or shine, during smooth sailing or on rough weather days, the InvestTalk listener line is open and waiting for your questions. You set the agenda. Don't forget to call InvestTalk 888-99-CHART.
Justin Klein is here and ready to take your calls live. Invest Talk, 888-99-CHART.
All right, now we just finished the first quarter, and we're going to check in on the worst performing stocks of the first quarter. They're always interesting to see where the pain points were in a quarter that was broadly higher. I think the S&P outperformed smaller caps for the first time in a long time, and I think that mainly is because of the worst performing sector, which were regional bank stocks. And a lot of those regional banks are small cap, and small cap on the value side typically. And so they really took it on the chin. And out of 844 U.S. listed stocks covered by Morningstar, 29 of them fell by more than 20%. Most of those were in the regional bank sector. Do you think that's the main reason for that outperformance of large cap over small cap in Q1?
Absolutely. You know, I think that nobody is going to be surprised by the fact that these regional banks are going to be the worst performers at the end of the quarter, because these are the things that are pretty much driving Fed policy. That's how severe the potential crisis was.
Yeah. And about 319 stocks declined during the first quarter compared to 608 that fell throughout the first quarter of 2022. So it was a much better quarter than last year. That's for sure. Now, the worst stock of the universe was First Republic Bank. It fell 88.5%, finished down 93.6 from its November 2021 high. And there were other regional banks that obviously were hit hard. Zions Bancorp down nearly 40%, Comerica down 34%, KeyCorp down 27%, and Charles Schwab, that was down 37%. Now, kind of in conjunction with that were the REITs, and the sector as a whole was the second worst sector, and it's very linked to that first worst sector, and that's because these REITs are very reliant on credit from these smaller regional banks. Regional banks, they tend to lend a lot in the commercial real estate space, and REITs, which require a distribution of 90% of their rental income to shareholders, means that they don't have a lot of retained capital in order to shore up cash, right? If you're trying to be safer, you hold a bunch of your earnings back instead of paying a big dividend, and you hold it as cash, and you're safer for the more difficult times. But REITs, they're not allowed to do that. They have to push 90% of that income into the dividend. And that means they're more dependent on these lenders rolling their debt, keeping their operations afloat. And so that's why there were major REIT stocks that were down about 25% or more. Vornado was a big one, down 25%. SL Green was down 28.4%. And mainly it's because they are focused on renting out office space. And it wasn't just the office space market. Unity Group, UNIT, that's a specialty REIT that focuses on cell towers and fiber optic networks. So you would think that's ultra safe, right? Because everyone's using their cell phone. But that was hit because of high leverage and poor credit rating. So do you think, which one of these trends do you think will continue, Luke, into the second quarter?
Yeah, I think some of the concerns probably surrounding the ability for and easy access to some of the investments that these banks made to deal with the fact that they had record amounts of inflowing capital is probably going to be certainly top of mind for the Fed going forward in terms of their policy.
Yeah, they're going to watch what's happening with the regional banks and whether they can stay afloat, because higher interest rates certainly, as you've seen, hit their balance sheet pretty hard and cause these bank runs. So that's something to watch. And then how much will it really impact the REIT sector, and will there be bankruptcies? And I do think there will be in the office space. So that's something to watch for the balance of the year. Now, we're going to take a break, but we are here ready and inviting your questions on Invest Talk at 888-99-CHART.
I do each weekday is host the Invest Talk podcast. I truly enjoy helping investors, and I know that every question counts and every answer I provide will be unbiased. You, the caller, get to chart the course for each Invest Talk podcast. call with your questions anytime, day or night, 888-99-CHART.
Hello, Steve, Justin. This is David from Portland. Love the show. I was interested in your take on Charles Schwab. It seems like a really good deal here. I feel like it's being thrown down in the mud with the banks and the banking debacle. And they're not really a bank. Anyway, I thought it was a good deal, so I'd like your take. And my one concern is that it's a publicly traded company, unlike Fidelity, which is private, or Vanguard, which is a mutually owned company. So if I was an investor at Schwab, I might be worried about the share price. I don't have to worry about that at Fidelity or Vanguard. So if you could talk a little bit about that, it'd be great too. Thanks, guys. I'll be listening on the podcast.
Well, I'll start with that last part because that's not true at all. The share price of Schwab matters not to the people who have their money at Schwab. When you have your money at Schwab, your money is isolated in a particular account. Even if Schwab went bankrupt, your money is safe. Not only is it specific insured, but it's siloed. It's in your bank account. It's not Schwab's money. You don't have an obligation. Unlike, was it FTX or was it Coinbase where if they go bankrupt, they might confiscate your
Coinbase assets? Put that in their disclosures, but I'm pretty sure that's how every crypto exchange operates.
Yeah, exactly. So this isn't crypto. these brokerage firms have been out a long time. So it's not commingled assets with Schwab's assets. So it's not like you have to worry about it, whether Schwab's publicly traded or Fidelity isn't, is all completely irrelevant. But I think what you're asking most of all is Schwab a good investment, right? It has fallen from a high earlier this year around $87 per share. Now we're at $50 per share. Based on forward-looking earnings, it looks pretty cheap. Supposed to earn somewhere in the $5 neighborhood next year, and it's trading at about $50. So you're talking about a 10 times forward-looking earnings. And what's interesting is Luke and some of the guys, we were bouncing around this in the office today about the risks involved of buying Schwab. And Luke, why don't you talk a little bit about that? What did we discuss in office on how to address the potential risk that Schwab has?
Yeah, certainly. I think, you know, what we were talking about is especially with a lot of financial institutions, you have regulatory risk and legislative risk. And that every 2 to 5 years, you have an issue arise to the general public. And there's a lot of push in Congress and in Washington to legislate and regulate, but it never really comes to fruition. So in this case, we're talking about the pay for order flow and how that might change the essential non-commission structure of companies like Schwab. But really the two benefits that you can think of with a company like Schwab is the two shuns, if you will, the consolidation of the industry and the integration, vertical integration of what their most recent merger is doing for them.
Yeah, and that synergy with TD Ameritrade, which that merger we know because our clients, TD clients, are going to be Schwab clients here in September. So that's when that merger is going to happen. TD moniker is going to go away, and they'll just be Schwab accounts. So I think that's overall a net positive for Schwab. But there are some, like you said, regulatory risks when it comes to payment for order flow. How is that going to be regulated? It sounds like they're going to change it to some degree, but probably in a way that still keeps it relatively lucrative compared to where it is today, and not materially impact their earnings too much. But I think you there is a bank there though, so that is something to pay attention to. You're right; it is a brokerage firm that they have a bank within it, where they own different types of assets. But the thing is, there's not really likely that run on the bank that you're going to get elsewhere. They have a pretty sticky deposit base, those with people that have money at Schwab. So we think, you know, we kind of came out on the side of it's a pretty good risk versus reward at this point. It's just a question of, do we want to take that risk with client money? You know, I'm not sure we're quite there yet. But it is interesting down here. Right, Luke?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that was Charles Schwab, SCHW. Now let's head over to Kevin in the Bay Area looking at ENPH Enphase.
Yeah, hi. Thank you guys for talking with us. I'm mainly interested in starting a position in this company. You know, it's kind of one of those companies that has, you know, pretty high valuations in terms of their PE and enterprise value to EBITDA. But in general, I think it's a good company. In terms of, you know, they're doing everything right and keeping debt and their debt levels and growing their earnings and revenue. Mainly just curious on what you both think of N-phase energy.
All right, this is N-phase energy, and they are a company that delivers smart and easy solutions to manage solar generation, storage, and communications on one single platform. This is mainly for rooftop solar systems. And they've obviously been growing pretty steadily over the years. They were losing money back in 2017. Now they're supposed to make $4 per share roughly this year, $6.29 next year. And analysts are upgrading those earnings expectations. But the chart is now in a downtrend, so that worries me a bit. Do you think it's too expensive, Luke?
I think it might be too expensive. Its price to book is 31. Its price to sales is 11. That still seems a little high. Just because something is a good company to invest in doesn't mean it may necessarily be a good time to open a position in that company.
Yeah, I mean, just because the like you said, the profitability metrics are solid, but the multiples are just simply too high. So I would pass on it for now, especially now that it's in a downtrend. Okay, so keep on your watch list and wait for it to get to more reasonable multiples. I mean, 11 times sales is almost rarely, it's rare that you make money buying things at 11 times sales. All right, we're going to head into a quick break. And after the break, we're going to go talk to Alan in Dallas. But for the rest of you, you can give us a call at 888-99-CHART.
Everybody wants a secure financial future. That means you'll have finance and investment questions. Justin Klein and Steve Peasley are ready to provide their unbiased answers. Invest Talk, 888-99-CHART.
Let's go talk to Alan. He is in Dallas. He wants to talk about unit investment trusts.
Right. I remember one time I was listening to you and I wasn't listening intently, and you said that there's a certain investment where it's just a hassle. It's not even worth investing because there are different IRS forms or whatnot. Is a unit investment trust that?
No, a unit investment trust is very similar to a mutual fund or a closed-end fund, but there is a particular end date, so it's and the portfolio is fixed. So you buy into this, you know exactly what's going to hold today and into the future. Whereas a mutual fund, for example, there is a manager there, and they could change that portfolio. There could be style drift, for example. They could be forced to sell if other investors redeem, right? And then they take some gains on some of their positions and kind of rebalance the portfolio. And so those things happen within a mutual fund, whereas this is a static allocation. You know exactly what you're getting, and many of them end at a certain date. So I think these are pretty straightforward, Luke. I think almost too straightforward, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think that it's certainly a unique thing that a lot of investors don't hear about often, but the level of clarity you get with the investment, like you said, you know what you're holding, and it really doesn't change because, in fact, there's no board of directors or corporate officers or really investment advisor that changes anything during the entire life of the trust.
Yeah, and even in like the S&P 500, there's the S&P, they change their index, and that can change, you know, that's going to change over time. And thus, if you own an SPY or VOO, that portfolio is going to change. Whereas a unit investment trust, it's not going to change. That's exactly what you're going to get. And you don't have to guess. I guess that's the upside. I don't know if I think it's really worth it, but no, these aren't ones that have some sort of special tax treatment or anything like that.
Yeah. And think about the downside potentially too, is that it doesn't change. You don't have that flexibility.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for the call, Alan. Now let's touch a bit on ESG ratings. And, you know, there's a lot of assets now. There's projected to be $50 billion in ESG funds by 2025. And there are a lot of firms that are now tasked to give ESG ratings to particular securities. And that wields a lot of influence. You know, it basically saying that these companies can or can't be included in ESG funds, which are getting more and more capital flows. And those companies that are doing these ratings, they're getting pretty high profit margins for it. So the question I think a lot of people's mind is, you know, is this transparent enough? And are they doing this more to make money? Is it really being effective, Luke?
Yeah, no, that's really just an excellent point to make, because one of the biggest concerns within this space is that there's no easily understood way to measure this. And regardless of your feelings towards the initiatives that a green company, for example, would take, there are risks associated with companies that are related to environmental issues, right? If the world is consistently changing more towards becoming ingrained in using renewable energies, and Exxon is not taking that risk seriously, that's something an investor should be concerned about.
Well, should they be concerned because it's higher risk?
Because it's higher risk for what's generating the company's profits.
Well, that's assuming that there is going to be that green transition.
Absolutely.
And then Exxon's going to be held back.
Absolutely. Right?
So I think there's a lot of assumptions in that ESG that if certain companies are not living up to these particular criteria, that they are in higher risk of some sort of financial ruin, I guess you could say. And I don't know if that's really true, you know, but most people believe that ESG ratings are a measure of corporate goodness. And I think both have the argument that they don't do a very good job of each. What do you think?
Yeah, that's my primary issue, because like I said, I don't look at it as an environmental issue and where you stand on that politically, but more is your company taking on and looking at all the risks that face their business. But if you don't have a succinct way to measure that and it's overly expensive, then the entire ESG rating system is useless.
Yeah, and like you said, if it's inconsistent, it's subjective, it's not regulated, and it has a lot of conflicts of interest. So it kind of reminds me a lot of the rating agency conflicts of interest back in whatever, 2005, 2006, right? Hey, we're going to use you to rate our bonds, but you know, hint, wink, wink, but you got to give our bonds a certain rating and we'll go to you, Moody's, or you, S&P. And guess what? Moody's and S&P are also involved with ESG ratings, along with companies Sustainalytics. And so I think that the question is, are the same conflicts of interest apparent, and are they doing a good job at reflecting the true risk, whether that is on impact or in the financial sense?
Yeah, and just to go along with that lack of consistency, you know, MSCI has a rating system that I'm familiar with, and S&P has their own rating system, and the level of overlap between those two, the correlation between those two ratings, is below 50%. Mm-hmm. So if we're all looking at the same things, how can that possibly be?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's going to have some, should have some high correlation. Otherwise, they're all using pretty different qualifications for ESG, and that just hits back to lack of transparency. What is MSCI's qualifications versus S&P's versus Sustainalytics, and which one's better and why? I think there should be a conversation about this, I think politically, right? Because that's really what this comes down to, is what are the politics behind these three measures, and what does ESG really mean? I don't think anybody knows quite yet.
No, no one knows, and it's like you said before, $50 billion by 2025, which means now that the money's moving there, you really need to get it right.
Yeah, exactly. Now let's pivot back to another Voice Bank question that came in earlier on 888-99-CHART.
Hello there, Dylan here from Houston, Texas. I've been listening a little over a year and love the show. I'm 25 years old and have a question about retirement funds. I am currently matching my employer's contribution of 3% through a simple IRA. I am then maxing out a personal Roth IRA through Fidelity. Through this, I'm buying the Vanguard S&P 500 ticker VOO and Vanguard's value ETF ticker VTV and switching those up every other month. Is this good enough, or should I be contributing more through another account? Secondly, I'm getting married in December of this year. Any recommendations on combining our retirement funds or keeping them separate? Thanks in advance.
Well, you can't combine retirement funds. Your 401k is your 401k. Your wife's is your wife's. Same with your IRA, your Roth IRA. You cannot combine retirement accounts with somebody else. So that's an easy answer there. Now, what your overall allocation should be is another story. And how much you should save, that's more of a question of your, you know, your total amount saved right now, your age, your risk tolerance level, your broad long-term goals, when you want to retire, et cetera. That's more of a retirement planning question. But when it comes to allocation, Luke, do you think just owning VTV and VOO is enough for somebody who's invested long-term?
You know, I think investing in value securities, as we recently talked about in a webinar, mm-hmm. is something that has had long-term empirical benefits. I think that is fantastic. I think getting some exposure to an S&P 500 fund, is that what it was, the Vanguard?
Yep, VOO, yep.
Yeah, an S&P 500 fund, that's fantastic as well. But it really depends on your time horizon. If you are younger, you can take more risks. If you're older, you probably need that capital sooner. So a lot of factors go into how you should allocate.
The prosperous future you envision for yourself and your family will not happen without strategic planning and definitive action.
Let's go to Brian in San Mateo looking at Roku.
And I wanted your take on the technical picture.
For the unprepared investor, market volatility around the world demonstrates risk. But opportunities wait for no one. And now may be the best time in years to invest wisely, to invest strategically.
What I would do is keep saving and look for other opportunities.
But how can you decide what sectors to avoid, which stocks to buy, and what might be the best price point?
I'm new to investing, and my friend Wesley recommended your podcast a year ago.
And how should you deal with your risk tolerance? InvestTalk. To prevail, serious investors need a balanced combination of realistic market education and unbiased guidance. KPP Financial Principals Steve Peasley and Justin Klein host a unique weekday finance and investment program and podcast, InvestTalk.
Hello, Justin and Steve. This is Joel calling in from Maine. I love the show. I'll be listening for your answer.
Is your asset portfolio properly balanced? How can you better manage your 401k? How will economic events affect the real estate market? So many questions. The straightforward answers can help you focus on your drive for success. You can learn more anytime at investtalk.com. The next decisive step on your path to financial freedom begins with a Spotify search for InvestTalk. Listen live or download the free podcast.
And I've got a question about warrant shares. I think that's the right term.
Got a question for Steve or Justin? 888-99-CHART.
Hi, Steve and Justin. It's Art from Tucson. Hey, I was wondering what you thought about the Dogs of the Dow investment strategy for 2023. Just to give you the freedom to discuss some of the stocks, three of the Dogs of the Dow is usually the top 10 that are down the most in the Dow Industrial Average. As I understand it, I was looking at 3M, MMM, Intel, INTC, and Walgreens, WBA. Those are three that are really down significantly. Just wondered what you thought about that theory. It's supposed to give superior gains over a lot of years, at least. And I'll listen to your answer on the podcast. Thanks for all you do.
Well, the Dogs of the Dow aren't the 10 that are down the most. It's the 10 highest yielding, dividend yielding stocks in the Dow Jones Industrial Average at the beginning of each year. And for this year, 2023, it'd be Verizon. It's about 6.6% yield. Dow Chemical, 5.5. Intel, 5.5. Walgreens Boots, 5.14. 3M, right around 5%. IBM at 4.68. Amgen 3.25, Cisco 3.2, Chevron 3.16, and JP Morgan right around 3%. So those are the Dogs of the Dow for this year. Now, is it better than just owning the Dow outright? Yes, numbers play out. However, this is just simply a value strategy. It's really what it is. You're using one simple metric, a decent metric, but only one metric. And some of these companies I would invest in, some of them not so much. And, you know, because it doesn't take into account leverage, quality of their earnings, growth, things like that, that I think are important. And the numbers say they're important. So Is this better than just buying the Dow? Yes. 888-99 chart, 888-992-4278. We have about, 9 minutes left in the show. So if you're going to call, you're going to do that right now. Now let's touch a bit on the job openings, the JOLTS data that just came in a couple of days ago. And for the first time in a couple of years, the total number of jobs opened was at 9.9 million. It fell below the 10 million mark in February. That's down from the 10.6 million mark in January. That was also downwardly revised, but still well above the 7 million that was pre-pandemic, February of 2020. Now, my question here, and I've said this to Luke a couple times, is how accurate is this data in the world of work from home? Because the way that they calculate this, they look at different regions. And if I'm posting a remote job, I might post it here in Los Angeles. I might post it in Seattle. I might post it in Orlando. And maybe that's counted three times. What do you think, Luke?
Yeah, no, that's a very valid point. It's also seems interesting to me because I feel as though every other month they're revising the way they're measuring something. For the first, what was the name of the data that came in today with the jobless claims? Sorry about that. For initial jobless claims, they had to revise the entirety of March up 50,000 a week because they're changing how they look at seasonally adjusted workers. So it's the world is changing. It's becoming inherently more complicated.
Yeah, that's definitely true, which is odd because you would think it would be easier with all the data that we're getting, that companies can get. The government seems to have trouble collecting the right data. Anyway, we're heading into our final break, so give us a call now at 888-99-CHART.
The stock market is constantly changing, and now with more than 50 million downloads, Justin Klein and Steve Peasley reaffirm their commitment to providing unbiased finance and investment guidance here on InvestTalk. 888-99-CHART.
Hey, Steve and Justin. I've owned Merck and AbbVie stocks for a couple of years now, and value's increased, and they have a good dividend yield. I was seeing your thoughts on it, if it's something I should keep, or since the value's gone up so much, maybe I should sell now and reinvest in a future date. Let me know your thoughts. Bye.
All right, this is AbbVie, A-B-B-V, and it's a very large pharma company, $286 billion market cap. And they mainly have exposure to immunology and oncology. Its top drug is Humira. It's close to half the company's current profits. So obviously there's a big question about the patent cliff on Humira. So I'd definitely look into that. Yeah, it looks like there is coming up on some patent issues with that one. So that's a pretty big risk, right, Luke?
Yeah, it's definitely a big risk from a valuation perspective. You know, AbbVie is currently sitting at a whopping 18 price to book. 16.52 price to book. It's pretty expensive.
Yeah, it's pretty expensive. Enterprise value to EBITDA is 14 times. Price to sales ratio is around 5. And like I said, there's worries of the Humira coming off patent, and there are biosimilar pressures in international markets that are likely to lead to declining sales. And right now, their sales are only 2% growth from here. So I think that's the biggest worry for AbbVie. Now, they're taking that cash and they're making smart acquisitions, like they bought Allergan a few years back, and that business is very strong. So I think that's a well-run company. The issue, I think, is just that Humira, and how much will there be loss of sales over the next 5 to 10 years or so. And then on top of that, you know, with the regulation that's coming down the pipe from Congress on the Medicare prescription drug prices, I think that's going to hold the company like this back potentially. And so I would be patient on AbbVie. I'd probably be cutting and maybe eliminating this name.
Yeah, in these scenarios and situations, I like to think to myself, not just how would that company perform, but how's it going to perform relative to other companies? We call that opportunity cost.
Yep.
So is it going to continue to perform better than other companies? Maybe, maybe not. I agree with Justin.
Yeah, and there will be, you know, they're doing some R&D on drugs that could usurp Humira in their reliance when it comes to profitability. But a lot of that's what ifs. So nothing has hit market that's going to be so far nearly as big as Humira. But they're certainly going to try. And once again, it's well run. So I think they're going to do as best a job as they can. But it's really hard to replace 40% of your sales. So I would, I would eliminate. I think there's better opportunity costs. Just drug companies in general. I don't know about you, Luke. I just don't see it as a great place to be invested right now.
Yeah, I agree too.
Now let's squeeze in another listener question from 888-99 chart.
Yeah, hi, Steve. This is Nick Khatri in Hayward. I just want to ask you if NVIDIA would be a good buy here. NVDA. I would appreciate your answer. And I thank you very much. And it's a great show. I enjoy your show a lot. And thanks again. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, now NVIDIA, it's been on a tear as of late, bottom in October on 110. Now it's at 270, so Ooh. It's up about 150% since its lows, but it's still well off its highs from a couple of years ago when it hit a high of $344 per share. What do you think of the valuation at this point after this rally, Luke?
Well, Justin, what would you say a reasonable price to sales would be for a company?
4 to 6.
Yeah, this one's got a 24.61.
Yeah. That's pretty egregious. Enterprise value to EBITDA is 110. I think this is a stone cold short. There's obviously a lot of hype around AI, and NVIDIA's chips are certainly important in that. But you know, are you really going to pay these multiples for a company whose earnings are down 33% year over year, sales down 21% year over year? So as hyped up as you want to be about the technology, their business, it's not doing very well right now. So I think this is a pretty good short candidate, if you ask me. All right, I think that about does it for today's show. I'm Justin Klein with Luke Guerrero, and this completes another InvestTalk program. Steve and I thank you for listening, and we encourage you to tell your friends and family about our free podcast downloads, which you can find anytime at iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. And be sure to rate and review on iTunes as well. And it's official. We have now surpassed the 51 million download mark since it all began. Back in 2008, imagine that we've been podcasting in 2008. InvestTalk has been around since the 90s. Pretty crazy, right? Now, independent thinking, shared success. This is InvestTalk. Good night.
InvestTalk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Steve Peasley is president, and Justin Klein is chief executive officer of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.